The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Several birds are dying for unknown reasons, an unknown disease, and wildlife experts are getting very concerned. They're saying if you have a bird feeder, they want you to take it down. Does that include the bird baths too?
You know, this disease, which is still unknown, by the way, a lot of experts say it could be easily transmissible in birds, and it's why they're asking people to take down their bird baths and bird feeders for the time being.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that is a weird story, isn't it? Let me fill you more. I'll fill you in more on that. I mean, I just... Look, the weather's been bizarre. Jake, pull the audio up on the birds. I'll share that with everyone in a second here. I want you to hear this. Yeah, I was just. I don't know how your weekend was. I hope you had a great one, by the way. You might still be enjoying your time off right now and tuned in. It's good to have you here with me. Boy, the weather's been unbelievable, hasn't it? I'm looking across the glass here at my call screener, Jim, and Jim's kind of fair skinned, right? Not today. He is red. Hey, open Jim's mic, would you, Jake? Let me see. Jim, what is up? What'd you do this weekend? Jim, by the way, he does a lot of work on a lot of different shows here. He's one of the great producers behind the scenes. That is so funny. How was your weekend? What did you do? You got so much sun.
You know what? We signed up for the pool this weekend.
Did you really?
Yeah, there's a great new pool nearby that just opened in over in De Pere, and it's just great. The kids love it. And so we spent every moment we could there.
You forget your sunscreen or no?
Yeah, I did. My wife gave me trouble about it, but, you know, what are you going to do?
You know what? It'll be tan by tomorrow, and people say, man, you look great. You look unbelievable.
It's usually what happens. And so.
Well, I'm kind of the same way. You know, I happen to have Italian blood, right? But I get sunburned that first time out, you know, and I hate wearing suntan lotion. You need to do it. It's an important thing to do. If you forget, you know, you're out too long, it goes red, but the next day it turns into tan, which is good. And Jake, what about you? You got no sun this weekend. I guess you were.
Oh no, I got some sun here.
Did you really?
Yeah.
A little bit on the arm.
Well, I was hanging out by the pool, but it's funny though, like coming from more Irish ancestry,
yeah.
I'm not one to tan much. It's usually just sunburn. Although there was one time I was at a pool years ago and I put on some actual like suntan lotion, not the sunblock. And I got really bad. It almost like kinda had like a blue sort of sun.
Oh, yeah. Oh, really?
And it was, like, really bad. I kind of looked like an Oompa Loompa from Willy Wonka. Like, some random guy at the pool just came over to see if I was okay. So, I'm like, I appreciate the concern, but, like, clearly this is concerning here.
So, somebody came up to you and asked you about
that? Yeah, some random dude. He's like, are you okay? And I'm like, okay.
So, my wife and I, we went out this weekend to watch the fireworks. We went downtown, right? Mm-hmm. And so, beforehand, we went out and we tried to grab a bite to eat, and she wanted a glass of wine, so I went up to the bar to order. The place was packed, right, where we were. And I'm there, and everybody's shoulder to shoulder, right? And I'm waiting. I finally get the glass of wine. I turn around, and this little guy, and, you know, people aren't normal. Not everybody's normal, you know, like somebody coming up and asking about your skin color.
Right.
This guy's like, you smell strange.
He said that to you?
Yeah. What? I said, excuse me? I thought I heard him wrong, right?
What?
You smell strange.
Is it how he said it?
Well, and I said, okay, thank you. I said to my wife, I said, you know, that guy just said to me, he said, I smell strange.
So what did he smell?
Maybe it was me. Maybe it was my perfume, she said. You know, I said, well, maybe it was my cologne. Who knows? You know, it's like, it was so weird. But most people don't come up to somebody, they call you an Oompa Loompa, Jake.
Didn't call me an Oompa Loompa. I was calling that myself.
Right.
If only Willy Wonka were around.
Tell you smell strange, you know?
Yeah. If Willy Wonka were around, he would have hired me. But no, I mean, this guy saying that to you, that's like a whole nother thing. That's not cool.
Yeah, no. People fundamentally are just good. I love people. I love to talk. I love to...
Yeah, well...
I just love to be with people. You know, I'm a people person. I like people, right? Kind of extroverted. But, you know, when you're out, people are... You know,
they're just some things you don't say. Like, you know, kids get a pass, right? Like, when kids say those kinds of things, it's cute. It's funny.
True.
Like, you know, you listen to the family rosary with Father Rocky, and kids say all kinds of crazy things, and it's hilarious. You know, people love it. But, like, when you reach a certain age, it's just kind of cringeworthy then to hear things like that. So,
and the other thing is, some people don't have, you know, you have two things. You have an IQ, right? Your intelligent quotients, and you have your EQ, right? Your emotional.
The street smarts, right?
And, I often tell my kids, I hope you have a higher EQ than you do an IQ sometimes. I know some brilliant people. I know a guy who writes code and plays music. And I mean, his father worked for NASA. His mother was a physician. This guy's he's off the charts, but he has no EQ whatsoever.
No street smarts, essentially.
None. He does not interact with people.
Yeah.
You know? There's not the proper filter there. I know a lot of people like that, actually. And some of the most successful people are people with a higher emotional quotient, EQ. You can read the signs, you can communicate, you can express yourself, you know, when to say something, when not to say something. So
it's interesting you mentioned that, because I think I'm more on the EQ side, where, you know, like, I've been going to trivia, my wife and friends, and I'm like, sorry guys, I have nothing to contribute here. I'm just going to keep eating my food and drinking my beer. But like, when it comes to like the social interaction, things like that, I think I'm on the extreme end, where I'm very, very sensitive to what other people might be like thinking or hearing, like based off of what I say.
Yep.
So it's almost sort of like an extreme like sensitivity to other people's emotions, which sometimes that can sort of be a detriment too. So it all sort of balances out, I guess.
But you pick up their vibe is what you're saying to
yeah
me?
Yeah, but almost to an extreme, where like someone might be in a bad mood and I'm like thinking, oh, like did I say something that? Was it something I said? But like, it just turns out, no, it's just like something else going on. But again, I think that there are positives to that too, that like you can kind of pick up on little nuances and such.
Well, I knew a person once around your age, and every time I spoke to him, he would say to me that, you know, this person doesn't like me, or that person, you know, there was some social anxiety involved with him.
He dealt with
some social anxiety. But at first I thought, man, that's really terrible. Why would that person talk to you like that? Or why would they treat you like that? Or why, you know, why does that job not work out?
Right.
But then over time I saw this pattern of behavior and I realized it's not all these people. It's your worldview. It's how you are seeing and interpreting things. I'm sure those people meant nothing by what they said. Like, for example, I took a shower and shaved and I went out with my wife, right, to watch the fireworks, and I probably smelled clean and good, but somebody, you know, said, you smell strange.
He smelled the soap and the shampoo.
That's what he said to me, right? And I'm thinking, you know, if this was this other person, he would have internalized that and taken it really personally. And it's just like, you know, I'm in talk radio. You know, I got thick skin. You know, the bullets fly off me. You know, I mean, people say all sorts of things to me. And you know that. You see what happens here.
Yeah, and you just kind of laugh.
But when we do even whatever we talk about, whether it's critical race theory or politics or whatever it is, you'll have people telling you you're super liberal. Somebody else will tell you you're super conservative. I mean, and we had the same conversation, and they hear the same show.
Selective
hearing,
right?
They process and internalize what they hear. It doesn't necessarily mean it was reality. I mean, they have their own filter that things go through. They talk about prophecy too. You know, a lot of these mystics and visionaries and people like that who give prophecy, they say all prophecy is imperfect because it goes through a human filter.
Yeah.
That's why
the
church is so prudent when it comes to these visionaries and sayers.
Sure.
And some of the things that come out. So I find it interesting.
Well, you know, you talk about that guy who would internalize everything. My thought is that maybe it's an internal projection, right? So the things that he thinks other people are saying or thinking about him is just simply what he's inputting it into himself, right?
That's right.
Like, it's just, oh, like, I think low of myself, so I just assume the other person is going to think the same way. So it really, it's just sort of the prism to which we look at our world and our interactions.
I'm just glad I don't have to deal with it. I mean, I pray every day. I mean, I literally pray every day for those who have social anxiety disorders and depression. As you know, in your own demo there, and even younger, more kids today, more young adults, and even, you know, middle-aged people are dealing with. I know a 50-year-old woman who's got anxiety. She's afraid to drive to work. I mean, it's like crazy. And I don't mean that. I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I just don't understand how crippling this can be. And I have to say, well, who cares what people think about you? You know, just who cares?
Right.
You know, don't let it.
Well, it is easier said than
done. My wife's like, Drew, you're so different. She says, you just can't say that. You don't understand what people are going through.
It's hard, you know. And in college, I had some social anxiety. And when I would tell people that I wanted to work in radio, like, some of them would even be surprised, because they're like, oh, like, you're kind of shy, things like that. So, you know, I think I've grown out of that a little bit, you know. But I kind of feel for those people. I have empathy for young people, especially.
I do too.
You know,
that's why I pray for them. And look, we've done shows on this. You and I have talked about it. I thought, this is different than my generation.
Yeah,
you know, when I grew up as a kid, I was out playing baseball, football, you know, soccer, riding my bike, doing whatever. Right? I was playing with other people. I was out. I didn't have a cell phone in my hand because they didn't have them then. You know,
I
had to go to the wall and take the phone off the wall and talk to somebody. You know,
yeah.
And, you know, television, you couldn't stream anything you wanted whenever you wanted. Shows came on at a certain time. Yeah. You know, I didn't have, computers came out when I was in college. I used to pound out my term papers on a typewriter until my one of my roommates got a computer. I'm like, oh my gosh,
what's this fancy new gizmo?
I can backspace here and I don't have to throw out the whole sheet of paper.
I don't know how. Okay, speaking from a generational thing, I don't know how you did that, honestly, because I'm always making typos and hitting the wrong keys. So
dude, I don't know how I did it either. I remember I did an internship when I was I think I was a junior in college, and I realized I wanted to be a journalist. Mm-hmm. I thought I'd be anchoring TV news. So I remember I did my internship at WCAU-TV in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. It was a CBS affiliate at the time. I think they switched. I think they're now NBC. But so I was one of only like three guys who got this very prestigious internship, mm-hmm. right? I mean, a whole bunch of girls and everything. And I remember when I went in for my interview, I bombed the interview. Mm-hmm. And it was here's a quick learning lesson, and I'll get back to the typing lesson. I go in for this internship, right? Because I knew I wanted to, and this is a major market, right? Mm-hmm. At the time, Philadelphia was, I think, the fifth largest market in the country. And I thought that'd be great to have, it'd look great on my resume when I get out. You know, I'm going to be around the best talent and the expertise. So I go in, we do this interview, and there's tons of people. They're from everywhere. Every university's there, you know. And I go in, and they do these series of interviews. And when I left, my last interview, I spoke to the news director. And I knew I just bombed it. I was terrible. And I'm walking down the hallway thinking, oh, I'm not going to work here. And I stopped in my tracks. Huh. And I did an about face. I turned right around. And I went back and I knocked on her door. And she says, yes, Drew? I said, look, I said to her, I know I did not really express myself well here. Sure, I didn't communicate well. So I really do want to work here. My father had worked at CBS years before that. And I said, I hope you'll at least consider me. And I was one of the two guys that got the internship at this place. Wow. Or one of the three guys.
That's cool.
And I think it's because I stood out. I was willing to come back and say, I know that's not who I am. And I did my thing. But when I was doing my internship there, right, I remember some of the journalists getting ready for the evening news. They would come in on these typewriters and go, and I think, oh my gosh, look how fast they think. Meanwhile, you know, I'm logging all these broadcast reports and I'm punching them in one finger at a time. I think, gosh, will I ever be able to type like that one day?
It
was just so slow. But then, you know, you get your computer. Now my typing skills are great and I could probably do the same thing. Final story on my internship, right? And I gave this lesson to my kids and I'll give it to anyone else who's listening. Sounds prestigious. I'm working, you know, at CBS in Philadelphia.
It is market number four still, by the way.
Is it number four? Is Philly number four still? So, I'm in this major market. I thought, this is going to look so great, right? The internship, I don't want to say be charitable with my words. It wasn't the best in this respect. So some of my college buddies who went to different, broadcast venues, they went to small little places. Let's say Altoona, Pennsylvania, or some tiny little market somewhere.
And then they get to do more.
You know, they learned more than I did. I mean, I sat in a desk. I traveled with a reporter. Everything was union where I was. I couldn't go into the edit bays. I couldn't handle a camera. I couldn't do any of these things, right? So all my buddies, they're carrying cameras, they're in the edit bays editing, they're doing all this type of stuff. They came away with their internship with more hands-on skills and I think a better knowledge base than I actually did, even though, you know, my internship said, hey, fourth largest market in the country, one of only a few,
And that was my experience, too, in college, you know, doing an internship in Chicago. Like, it was pretty much just to put it on the resume, but you really didn't get to do as much as, you know, you actually expected. So
yeah, that's so true.
Yeah.
Well, that's my life lesson. I try to communicate some of those things to my kids.
Your next book will be advice for internships, right?
Advice for the aspiring whatever, right? Yeah. I mean, who knows? I am thinking about another book, though. I've got one coming up. I just thought, you know, I got a great testimony on my book, too. I was going to share it during the chaplet. One lady wrote to me. She had all these intentions she was sharing with me, but she says, I gave it to my sister. My brother-in-law is, he was either atheist or Protestant. I mean, he just didn't believe, right? Read the book, and now he's praying the chaplet every day. So,
Praise God.
I love it. Yeah, I mean, here's a guy who, I think she said he was an atheist, didn't believe in God. Now he's now praying the chaplet. So, that's the power, the fruit of divine mercy. And we'll pray that in about 45 minutes. So, do yourself a favor, tell others, and get them plugged in to that. Hey, I'll bring you up to speed on some other news, but let me share with you what's happening right now in Canada. I received an email, speaking of email, from a listener who says, I love the show. Can you tell me what's going on in Canada? There's a lot of disturbing news coming out about mass graves being found on the sites of former schools in Canada where Native American children were sent to be educated. And those are known as, you know, residential schools, and they've come under fire recently, you know, for being places where these kids were sent. A lot of people are saying that the purpose was to remove their native cultures from their children. And maybe that's true. I don't know. But what they did is they found these unmarked graves. And because they're finding these unmarked graves, it has only made the situation worse. And some people have responded very violently. Several churches on these native lands, they've been burned to the ground. In fact, police in Calgary, Alberta, they're investigating 11 Catholic churches that have been painted with orange and red paint. So say a prayer for our neighbors up in North Carolina. up in Canada. I don't know where that came from. North in Canada is what I meant to say. I got a sister in North Carolina.
You got to say up north.
Right? I got to say up north. I got a sister in North Carolina, and that's why North Carolina rolls up. But up north in Canada. But anyway, let me share this report from Global News. If you're not familiar with the story or if you heard something about it, they'll fill you in on all the details.
Calgary police are investigating after more than 10 churches in our city were vandalized, and investigators believe it's in response to the unmarked graves recently found at former residential schools.
Police do say that vandalism like this is not only illegal, that it can create even more of a divide, fear, and destruction in our city. Now, you can see there is still a bit of red paint left on this church sign here. Everything else, though, has been cleaned up for the most part, because members of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary Ukrainian Catholic Church here worked throughout the day on that cleanup. When they arrived this morning, they found red handprints scattered across the front of the church, the number 751 painted across that sign, and the number 215 written in red on the pavement. Those numbers, of course, reflecting the number of unmarked graves found in Kamloops and Saskatchewan.
Yeah, at first it was a mystery. Like, what do these numbers mean, right? I've been reporting, and I've been giving to you news about what's been transpiring here in America too, right? On the vandalism and the desecration and the destruction of a lot of our churches. Police in Calgary, Alberta, they're investigating 11 Catholic churches that have been spray painted with orange and red. And you heard the numbers there. Even in Denver, though, in Denver, Colorado, someone spray painted the side of a church in downtown that is a very active outreach to the poor and to the homeless, with a number seems to reference what's going up on Canada. So maybe they're following the story there, or maybe somehow they're copycats. I don't know. But much blame for this is being put on the Catholic Church. But, you know, that's not the whole story. It really isn't. There are unfortunately instances of some kind of kids being physically or sexually abused. And just, I want to come out, as we always say, it's just horrific. And it's absolutely wrong. But that's not the totality of what has happened. Joining me in a moment, I'm going to be speaking to a Canadian lawyer. And this woman served in private practice for a while as a crown prosecutor with the federal government, where she specializes in immigration and Aboriginal affairs there. And she's been following this in tremendous detail. And we'll bring you up to speed on what is what's happening up north. What I will ask you to do is to say a prayer. All right, really, it's tragic. The numbers are continuing to mount, and we'll see what happens. So, joining me right now is Gwendolyn Landault. As I said, a wonderful Canadian lawyer. She's also one of the founders and is currently national president of Real Women of Canada. It's good to have her here with us today. Hey, Gwendolyn, good afternoon. Thank you for your time.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
This is an amazing story. We only have a few moments here. Could you maybe give us an overview of what these residential schools were and why they were set up and now what's being reported?
Well, they were, first of all, the Protestant Catholic missionaries with settled Canada, and they set up schools, in some cases hospitals, for Aboriginals. And then in 1883, the federal government, Department of Indian Affairs, took over the residential schools. And the purpose was that the children, to try to teach the children education and vocational schools, because even then, the hunting and fishing, which was where they subsisted on, wasn't going to carry them through into the future. So the idea was to help the children. So the schools were set up, but the schools were funded by the federal government, and they administered them, and they asked the religious groups, and they were Methodists, Presbyterians, Catholics, to administer them, because, of course, it was cheaper to have religious people running the schools. Right. So the religious groups were administering them, but they were under the control and responsibility of the federal government, Indian Affairs. And during that time, from 1883, there was a great problem with tuberculosis, and the Aboriginal people in Canada were three times more TB than any other, than the other Canadians. And that took a lot of lives of the students. Then also we had the 1918 Spanish flu, and at that time there was no sulfa drugs, no penicillin, and no inoculations for children. So death rate, not only of Aboriginal children, but all children, was quite phenomenal in those days. And the statistics show by 1948, we had penicillin and some so-called miracle drugs, and the death rate of children had decreased quite appreciably. Yeah. But one of the problems was the Indian Affairs, when a child did die from 1883 on, they refused to pay for their funeral expenses, and they refused to pay for the cost of, of transporting the child back to their communities. And of course, transportation in those early years was difficult anyway. But they refused to, and they refused to pay. So the religious who ran these schools were obliged to open cemeteries on the residential school grounds, which they did when the children died. They had to bury them somewhere. But they were not just the Aboriginal children who had passed away in the school, but the teachers and the teachers' family, and also the religious people.
Gwen, the news reports that we're hearing here make it sound like they're finding bodies that were just dumped indiscriminately into holes, and they can almost sound like there was some kind of massacre going on. That's not the reality, was it?
Absolutely not. And there were people from nearby municipalities buried in there. And these news reports, there's no way they're using radar, but they know there's bodies. And also, they knew that they were there. They say it was newly discovered. Well, they knew that the cemeteries were attached, and the churches only put the cemetery because they were obliged to, but nobody would pay for the maintenance of the cemetery, not the Indian Affairs Department, not the municipality were using them. And so over time, the wooden crosses that marked the graves, the over time the fences surrounding the cemeteries deteriorated by weather, and many of them were simply lost or forgotten. And the schools were closed in 1996.
Right.
The Canadian, there was a commission set up in 2013 in Canada called the Truth and Reconciliation and Commission. And they reported, they had Dr. Scott Hamilton, who is an anthropologist at a university in Canada, to study these cemeteries. And Dr. Scott said that they aren't just the bodies of children. They were known. The report for the National, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was made public in 2015, and they had a whole volume, volume four, discussing the making recommendations with regard to these cemeteries.
Hey.
So to say they're newly discovered was really outrageous.
Gwen, Native leaders have demanded that Pope Francis issue an apology, and I was struck by that. It's one of the things I'd love to get clarity on. Why should Pope Francis apologize if everything you're telling me is accurate, which I believe it is?
Well, exactly. They were people who donated their lives, and that's what's really troubling, because these were nuns, priests, ministers, people, missionaries, who really cared. Now, I'm sure there were incidents of when things were, well, there may have been abuse. I'm sure the diet could have been better if the government would give more money. But these people did the best they could, the majority. I'm sure there's exceptions. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission did have some very positive stories, but that has not been picked up. Some people say their happiest years were in the residential schools. Others, of course, one of the things, the Canadian government decided they would give a certain sum of money to every child who was in a residential school, and lawyers, I'm sorry to say I'm a lawyer too, would go around to all the reserves saying, give us your name, we'll bring our class action suit, and they'll get lots of money from the government. And the government did generously try to, you know, children who had to leave their homes to go to the residential schools, but the lawyers, unfortunately, really cut off the top of the money. And some of it reached the individuals, but a lot went to the lawyers, and they've gone to the Law Society to complain about their abuse, their position as acting on behalf of the Aboriginals. But well, it's very unfair.
Yeah, it is. And we're going to continue to follow the story. Gwen, thank you for your time. I wish we had a little bit more time to talk, but these residential schools are, I think, a great opportunity for people to understand the true history behind what went down there, and I just hope the media will report it accurately. I'm grateful for your time today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for asking me. Bye-bye.
God bless you. You can learn more at realwomenofcanada.ca. That was Gwendolyn Landolt. I'll be back. Stay with me.
Support for Relevant Radio is provided by the University of Mary. Monsignor James Shea is the president of the University of Mary. Come to Mary.life.
Facts and faith over fear. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, it is good to be with you today. Thank you for joining me. I was just listening to Father Kubicki in my headsets. He always gives a great commentary. Jake, I don't know, does that go over the national feed or is that just here?
Not every station.
All right. Well, those who heard it got to hear a little bit today about the great saint, Saint Maria Goretti. Today, of course, is the memorial of a 12-year-old child who died violently at the hands of a neighbor who wanted to violate her. I actually prayed at her tomb many times over in Italy. What a heroic saint, and what a model for all of us today. And again, you know, we live in a culture that has become pornified. We live in a culture that has been hyper-sexualized, right? But it's not new. I mean, of course, we've got pornography and a whole myriad of other things that, you know, heighten those senses and have really changed even the brains of a lot of our men. But you know, we're dealing with a woman who died before any of this. You know, there was probably pornography, but it wasn't. There were no computers. You know, I lived in a very rural area of Italy, and Alessandro, who was the neighbor, found her attractive, and he wanted to violate her. She refused his advances, and in his rage, he tried to rape her, and she resisted, and then he stabbed her. Over and over and over again. Now, she was put on a horse, a carriage, a wooden carriage, over very rocky terrain, drugged to the local hospital by horse, bleeding literally to death. She forgave him. She forgave him after what he just did to her, literally moments ago. She actually died the next day in the hospital from her wounds, but the thing that resonated wasn't the violent act or even the loss of a 12-year-old or, you know, the horror of this incident. What resonated, the imprint that was left, was her heroic act of forgiveness. She's a martyr today. Of course, she died for chastity, one of the many that the church has had through the centuries or others. You know, St. Agnes or St. Agatha, who've so many of these saints consecrated themselves to Christ and refused you know, the offers of marriage, even from, you know, kings, even from emperors, you know, they refused the sexual advances of men. And they were truly heroic in their resistance to those advances. But a lot of people today would say that they, you know, uselessly gave up their lives. All they had to do was go along and they would have lived. You know, their mind wasn't in it. Their heart wasn't in it. It was just their body, right? That you hear that sometimes today. It couldn't be more false. There are other saints like St. Benedict of Francis who took truly heroic measures to resist temptations of the flesh. You know, St. Francis threw himself in a thorn bush when he had lustful thoughts. And you think of some of the others who self-flagellated or did other things to overcome one of the great weapons of the evil one. And today, you know, what they would do, you know, somebody hears that, they think, gosh, they must have psychological problems, right? But no, they understood how important chastity was, how important purity was in the spiritual life. And I, you know, I think they're models for today. And I think we should turn to them at a time when I think Satan has found a tool, a weapon, in which he is just laying waste to this next generation. You know, look, it's every generation, right? It's not just our young teens or young adults. It's every generation. I have many friends who are priests. And without disclosing the penitent's confession, they tell me that's probably one of the number one things that they hear in the confessional. A little bit later, and I hope you'll stay with me, I heard a conversation from an exorcist who talked about what pornography does in terms of throwing open the doors of your home and your lives to the evil one. And I think we need to bar those doors. We need to lock those. So some tragic numbers, and we've been through these a million times. I won't belabor them, but they say the average age for exposure to pornography today, take a guess, you know, 16, 15, 14, 13, 12, 10. What do you say? How about 9 years? How about 9 years of age? Can you imagine a nine-year-old seeing that type of material? What's that do to that child? So the big question we have today, the problem that we face is, how do we confront this? How do we protect young people from it? How do we help them get out of the grip of it so that their minds and hearts, like Maria Goretti, can be pure? They can grow in holiness. They can fulfill the great mission that God has created and destined them for. I'm joined today by Monsignor James Shea. He's been dealing with this as president of the University of Mary, and he joins us today for some perspective. Monsignor, welcome back. Good to talk with you.
Great to be with you, Drew. God bless you, and happy feast to Maria Goretti.
Happy feast day to you. Before I talk Maria Goretti or we go anywhere else, I just want to congratulate you. I was driving into the studio today, and I heard a wonderful thank you that broadcast over the Relevant Radio airwaves. And it was congratulating the University of Mary for being the number one nursing school in the country. I'm like, hey, I'm talking to Monsignor today. That's fantastic. Look, there's a lot of nursing schools in this nation. That is quite an achievement. Congratulations. How'd you get that? And you know, feel free to let people know about it. I think it's fantastic.
We're very grateful. Thank you so much, Drew. Yeah, there are more than 2,100 nursing programs in the United States, and there's a board certification that nurses, after they graduate, have to take called the NCLEX exam. Mm. And so those numbers, the results of the NCLEX exam, are very carefully watched. We have, I think, four different tracks of nursing for the bachelor's degree in nursing here at the University of Mary. So, for instance, you can go all the way through and get your bachelor's degree from the time you're a freshman. You can come in with an associate's degree, like an RN degree in nursing, and then get your bachelor's degree in nursing. We even have a program where if you have any other bachelor's degree in accounting or botany or teaching, you can come in 1 year of intensive study, you can get your bachelor's degree in nursing. So all of those programs together, they take them, Drew, in the aggregate, and they watch very carefully the number of students who pass their NCLEX examination after graduation on the first try. Right. And we've had 100%, so many years in a row that they named us the sort of ranking agency, which is called Mountain Measurement, and they keep track of all of the NCLEX exam graduation rates and pass rates, and we have the highest pass rate in America.
And
so it's great in the midst of just as we're coming out of a massive pandemic, when the importance of nursing and the vocation of nursing has never been more clear to our culture for a Catholic university like ours, which has a very strong bioethical concern and trains our nurses to care not simply for the physical needs but for the spiritual needs of their patients. For us to have the number one program in the country is a great testament, not just to the University of Mary, but to the power of Catholic education to really form the whole person, heart and mind.
I was just blown away by the 100% number. I mean, I could see 95, 94, 97, but 100% is, it speaks to your institution and the fact that these are well-formed, well-educated future nurses. So congratulations. That's phenomenal.
It's a great point of pride for us, but not pride in the bad sense.
No, of course.
But we're just very humbled and very grateful. And I'm grateful to my faculty. We have the St. John's School of Health Sciences, and that's where our nursing program is. Our associate dean of nursing and the chair of the nursing department and all of our nursing faculty, they work together and give those students a tremendous technical education with a strong Catholic base.
That's great. Hey, Monsignor, quick plug. I mean, if people want to sign up or get more information, what's the best way to do that?
You know, they could jump on to cometomary.life. If they go to cometomary.life or just our regular website, umary.edu, either of those would give you plenty of information.
Well,
and again, if you've got another degree in anything, you can come back and get a bachelor's in nursing in one year here.
So I could be a nurse in a year. That's not bad.
in a nurse in a year. That's right. Drew Mariani, the nurse in the radio.
That's right.
Tremendous.
I often say that. Like, I'm about 6'3", probably 240, 230, something in that area. And I'm thinking, I look at these nurses. I'm like, how are they going to lift me the heck up if I'm in the hospital, right? And so, I mean, male nurses are really important too, and I think some of the best nurses out there are these male nurses. We need them, and gosh, what a beautiful vocation that is too—to administer mercy to others. Nurses do a lot of hard. My sister was a nurse, so I know how much effort goes into it. So, congratulations! I'm really happy when I heard about that. I'm proud, and I don't mean that in a bad sense either. I was proud to hear your university, a good Catholic institution, ranking number one in a desperately needed field. So. That's great stuff.
It's tremendous.
My guest today, thank you. Monsignor Shea, you can join us if you want to pull up a chair. We always love to hear from you. The number's 888-914-9149. We were talking today just a little bit about Maria Goretti and chastity and some of these great martyrs of chastity and porn and so many of the other threats that we have today. And Monsignor, you've been working hard on changing that the culture of your school, both in terms of academics, but also in terms of student life. And yeah, as a university president, I'm curious because the stats I see, early exposure to porn is 9 years old, nine years old for some kids. But, if you think, oh gosh, high school kids have their cell phones, college without a question. This has really had to change the college campus environment. I mean, when I went to college, there weren't the cell phones like they have them today or the easy accessibility to pornography like there is today. How are you dealing that, and how are you ministering and helping people stay free from that?
Yeah, so this is so we talk about a very exciting thing with the nursing ranking, and then we go to a real somber thing. This pornography and the pornification of our culture and the struggles that our young people, including and maybe especially our young people who come to us with good hearts from great families and who want to really make a go of it for Christ, who want to live their faith vibrantly and well, pornography is something which just really ensnares the hearts and minds of young people in a super insidious way. And, whenever people of a certain age, you and me, when we're talking about it, Drew, we'll talk about how difficult it was back in our day when we were young to come across pornographic material. You could come by it, but it wasn't something that was sort of ubiquitous and all over and that you could stumble on almost accidentally. The internet has changed all of that. And I think, of course, as we're praying today to Maria Goretti, as we're thinking about the heroic story of her witness to chastity, and even as we're thinking about the profound conversion that Alessandro Serenelli, her assailant, who killed her, the amazing conversion that he underwent in prison, how his mind and his heart was turned to the Lord, how Maria appeared to him in prison and how he was at her canonization in 1950. It's an amazing thing for him to be at the canonization of the girl whom he killed. As we're thinking about all of that, I'm, of course, thinking about our students here at the University of Mary and young people all across the world who have access at their fingertips from their iPads and their phones and their computers to some really hardcore pornography, which can really damage their capacity for self-gift, which is what the sort of sexual faculty in the human person, we were given that by God, male and female, for not just the proliferation of the species, but for the expression of love within the bond and covenant of marriage. And there's something, of course, this has always been for human beings. It's always been, lust has always been one of the most sort of poignant and tragic effects of the fall. The way that instead of loving each other, we're tempted to use each other. But I'll tell you, so I sit in the confessional along with all the other priests here on our campus for hours and hours and hours on end all through the year, including the summer, because we have year-round campus, and so we hear a lot of confessions in the summer. But during the main academic year, you know, from September to April, you know, we hear hundreds of hours of confession every week here on campus. And I'll tell you what the priest friend you were referring to earlier said is true. So much of what we hear, not just from young men anymore, but also from young women, is a struggle with an addiction to pornography, which arises from this sort of the sort of addictive character of it and the availability of it. And so there's and there are a lot of things which spiral out from that. You know what I mean? It's not like we have some of the best students in the world here at the University of Mary, but who come from amazing Catholic families. You know what I mean? And they went to great Catholic schools and they got a great education. And their hearts are full of the Lord, and they want to serve Him with all their hearts, but they feel divided because there's so much shame for them around this question. And so we hear confessions, of course. We offer seminars and discussions around this question. We have support groups here on campus. We have a clinical psychologist who students are able to meet with to discuss this. And what we found is that prayer and fasting, encouraging young people to pray and to fast, is really, really important and crucial in terms of this battle. But the most important thing, in addition to prayer and fasting, which is the help from the Lord, which is necessary, the most important thing is for them to know that they're not alone. In other words, this is the type of thing, especially in the midst of this crisis, that young people can't face alone. We have to support them.
I think you're right on so many fronts. When we come back, I want to play a piece of audio from an exorcist. I want your take on this, but I think you're right. I think at the heart of what we're seeing here is something very spiritual. I think true liberation and freedom comes through that sacrament of reconciliation and letting people know, hey, this is not a solitary thing. You're not alone. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Your life connected. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me. We're going to pray the chaplet coming up here in about 10 minutes. So tell others and be sure and join us. You can stream it. You can listen to the station. But let's ask God for mercy on our country. Let's ask Him for mercy on those we love and especially ourselves. If you're struggling with pornography, I want you to listen to what I'm about to play. It's a piece of audio that I think is eye-opening. I listened to this morning. I think it was God's providence that it came across. You know, I loved John Paul II. One of the things he's always said always resonated with me. He says, as the family goes, so goes the nation, and so goes the whole world in which we live. And he understood that everything depends on the family. The family is where we learn our faith. The family is where we learn to love. The family is where we learn our nation's culture, right? And he says, look, it's not just the foundation to society. It's the glue that holds us together. So you know that Satan has a special enmity, right, against the family. And he wants to use a very effective tool to divide it, to take down fathers, to take down men, to corrupt them young, to get them hooked, to get them addicted. I saw a great piece of audio from an exorcist earlier today, and he talked about why Satan tries to diminish masculinity and what happens, gentlemen, when you, and ladies too, when you throw open the doors of your home to pornography. Listen to this.
If you look at the first thing that Satan did with Eve is to get her to make the choice on her own to step out from out the authority of the husband. So his attack is always on the authority structure in some fashion. This is why masculinity, which we can talk about maybe a little bit later, but masculinity is under such severe attack. But it's also the same thing that, and then what did Adam do? When he took the fruit from Eve, he capitulated his authority. So that's the undermining of the authority structure was one of the first things that Satan was actually looking for. If the two principal functions of an authority is to provide and to protect. So if the father is not protecting the family spiritually, not just physically and morally, but spiritually by doing the prayers and saying those things and keeping watch over the home, etc. And if the wife doesn't submit to that right in a rightly ordered way to that authority, then what happens is that it becomes the segue for the demons to affect the children because the authority structure has been affected. And so those who are supposed to be protected by the authority structure, namely the wife and the children, are not being protected. So This is one of the principal reasons why in our line of work, one of the things that we'll do is we actually ask them and in our intake form to find out exactly what is the family structure really like, because if there's serious disorder, that's got to get straightened out, because if it doesn't, a lot of times you're not going to clean up the problem. So yes, right. If the father doesn't maintain his authority within the home, according to the mind of Christ, obviously treating his bride, his family and his wife like the bride of Christ, etc., as Christ talks about in Ephesians, if he doesn't do that, then the children become actually susceptible. Conversely is also the case. If he is engaging in sin, he's actually in mortal sin, he's inviting the demons into the home. And this is one of the reasons why you'll even see this, where the father will be committing, usually it's pornography, that's the thing we run up against the most in relationship with the father and the son. The father will begin using pornography, and then the next thing you know, the child, who is not even being exposed to pornography, starts being barraged with impure thoughts and stuff, and he doesn't even know where it's coming from, and he's perplexed by it. So the point being is the father is in a certain sense the gateway, but he's because he determines who comes in and who doesn't in relationship to the home, spiritually speaking. But then in addition to keeping the demons out, it's also his place to invite all the angels and the saints in. And so this is one of the reasons why it's the father's place, not the mother's, even though the mother can aid the father in doing it. It's the father's primary obligation to make sure that the prayer life within the family is done properly. It's the father's place to make sure that the children are saying their prayers, and the children need to see the father saying his prayers so that they recognize this is part of justice in relationship to God that any real man would render or do. And also it teaches the girls, this is the type of man that I want to marry. That is the man who's going to be just to God, and therefore he's going to be just to me.
And we see today, I think, in a very vivid way, how the evil one wants to not only destroy the family, but is using pornography as a portal into destroying families. And you see the ripple effect down the family line there. I'm joined today by Monsignor James Shea, president of the University of Mary. And Monsignor, I love your take on that. We started talking about Maria Goretti, this great martyr of chastity and purity. I think underpinning all this, you talked about what's happening on your campus. You know, it's a spiritual thing at the very heart of all this, as you just heard.
Yeah, the reflections of the Father Exorcist there were very poignant, speaking about how the family is under attack and how the enemy is constantly trying to undermine the purity and the authority necessary for people to get to heaven. And so I think that that understanding this as a specific attack upon men, that jives with my experience in working with young people both at the college level, which I've been doing now for 12 years, and before that even when I was a high school chaplain. I saw that if Satan can manipulate shame and cause shame to grow up in the hearts of men, then they lose their confidence. They lose their ability to move through the world in a confident way as sons of God, who are meant to fulfill a great vocation and to give their lives away in love. We always say to our students, Drew, that's what you're made for, to give your life away in love. And shame, especially in the heart of a man, undermines that because it turns him in upon himself. And so pornography is one of the tools that the enemy is using quite vociferously here in our culture right now against young men. And I do see the effects of it. And the antidote to it isn't just natural. It is spiritual, as you said.
Yeah, my guest, Monsignor James Shea. And Monsignor, I have a moment or two left. So final thoughts. What's the solution to this? How do we move forward? How do we protect our children? How do we protect ourselves?
Well, as I said right before the last break, one of the things that we found to be most effective is that good intentions aren't enough with a plague like this. Because as you and I were talking about when we were during the break, it is a question of brain science too. The addiction to pornography gets inside the mind and affects the structures of the brain such that an addiction then needs to be broken. And so I think that the spiritual aspect, prayer and fasting, are vital. And once you've got those in place, then you need to provide structures of support as well so that young men and women who are struggling with the scourge of pornography and the addiction of pornography in their life don't feel like they're alone, that they have a group of peers who can keep them accountable, and that they have access to resources such that they can begin to heal and live lives that are not just whole, but holy.
Amen. My thanks to Monsignor James Shea, President of the University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota. You can learn more at umary.edu. You can also go to cometomary.life or just give them a quick call. All right? We'll pray the chaplain when I return.